Welcome to an iTech 15 speaker presentation. This file has been brought to you by Christian Education National. Enjoy and connect to www.cen.edu.au for more information.
I thought we're obviously quite a small group, so governance is not that exciting after which is fair enough. I find it that way too. As soon as you put the word compliance anywhere near it, it's like, just before we get going, what we might do is I'll just get each of you to introduce yourselves and where you're from. It's probably a good way, and maybe we can get a little bit of chat going if you wish along the way, if you have questions and comments as we go through. But if I can just ask you to introduce yourself and let me know where you're from and all that sort of stuff.
Jeff Neal, he's a college at the University of South West Melbourne. Since I was doing that kind of administration, but just recently, just a bit inquisitive about this whole about governance, and then if you were starting up a school compared to maintaining a school, what are the prerequisites, apart from the ongoing issues that you're pointing to?
Sure.
So I'm just a secondary teacher at the moment. Not involved in any administration or organisation of the school.
I'm Phoebe, I'm from Darwin in Northern Territory, and I work with two Christian schools. My role is in policy development and governance, risk and compliance areas. I have the blessing of being able to support the executive teams and the principals of each of our schools as we manage different things that come up each time, and also have the privilege of being able to work for our board in different areas as well as we look, particularly in policy development and things like that. I was legally trained and worked as a solicitor for a while in Sydney, and then headed up to the Territory and haven't looked back since. Sure.
I'm Bevan, and I come from Darwin too, from NT Christian Schools. And I chair the board of NT Christian Schools. So that's my part-time hat.
And what's the day job?
And my day job is, I'm involved, actually not in education, I'm not an educationalist at all. I'm involved in the medical industry, have been for quite some time. So my wife and I, we own a series of medical businesses where risk is very high in the medical industry.
Yeah.
So that's something that I understand. So I'm really in the business space, so I'm effectively a businessman in that awful but lovely commercial world where we make money. I guess I could probably be provocative and say I view money similarly to rock and roll. It's like, why should the devil have all the good music?
Well, I'm going to use it.
I don't mean that facetiously. I think that there is a place for commercial engagement in the Christian sector. And I guess wearing my two hats of being board chair in a not-for-profit and working very closely in the business world in the commercial sense, I know which one is actually more difficult. The commercial space is not an easy place to be as a Christian, but it's a very rewarding and very challenging one at the same time.
Excellent. My name's Caleb Cooper and I'm from Hobart. I am Deputy Principal at Calvin Christian School and I oversee all the curriculum and learning. I moved over from New Zealand at Christmas with my family, and in my last school in New Zealand I was on the school board of trustees. I was the what we call the staff trustee, so I represented all the staff, or gave a staff perspective on governance issues and the impact on would have on staff. So I served a term there. So currently now, a lot of my focus is on policies and how they live out in the school and affects our staff. And we've got a few policies that need reviewing. And so I sort of getting up to speed with the current practice in Australia.
Yeah. Whereabouts in New Zealand?
Christchurch.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
And is it true that the All Blacks are going to choke just before the... They're going to choke in the World Cup, they're going to peak just before the World Cup and then choke?
No, because last World Cup we won it.
Oh, that's right.
What's going to happen is we will win it again.
Oh, that's what you're going to
win.
Yeah,
yeah,
yeah.
He obviously hasn't crossed over.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh,
we better win it.
It's all about AFL in this country, mate.
Yeah, which, sorry, we knew that's a good thing.
Sorry.
Well,
Lydia?
To Melbourne 20 years ago. My husband's a minister of religion, so we took over a church, and I was fortunate enough to find a job in a Christian school, Northside Christian College, which has just recently gone through the Royal Commission. I was there for 18 months in a variety of leadership roles. I helped the school at that stage write policies and all those sorts of things. And then the Lord's taken me to John Bell Christian College 18 months ago, which is really, really lovely. Leadership role there, but leaving Northside, they actually asked me to join the board. So it's actually a real privilege to take on that role, and I'm really excited about that. So I guess I'm here to learn a little bit about governance, risk, and compliance, and be a good board member for as
well. Hi, Caleb. I'm Chris Wally.
Yeah, I just sort of read your tag.
Yeah.
Like,
sorry, we actually work in the same association, and I've heard about this guy called Caleb. Anyway, I'm Chris Woolley. I'm principal of Sibley. Well, I actually say we're the grandchild of Calvin. So we're part of Christian Schools Tasmania, and I'm here because we go up for registration next year. We've been doing a whole lot of our review of our documents and things like that. So I'm number one wanting a place where all documents can be, and I know Simon and Ryan are doing a lot of conversations around that sort of thing, but I wanted to know more because I'm sticking there. So.
Cool. Okay. Well, we'll touch on that. So the way I ran this yesterday, and Brian was in here yesterday as well, was just put it out to you guys. So at the end of yesterday, I did a bit of a practical demonstration. Now, I'll give you a bit about me in a sec, but unashamedly, what ComplySpace does, what we do is provide policy management systems to schools and assurance management systems. And I can do a 5-minute demo at the end to show you practical application of a lot of what I'm talking about. It's up to you whether or not you want to see that. So a quick bit about me. So my background is employment lawyer, originally compliance lawyer, financial services lawyer. Business partner and I have been working together for almost 20 years now, so he's sort of mentor partner to me. I like to say he's 12 years older than me, although he looks younger than me, which is a bit shameful for me. And my background is I actually kind of grew up in rural New South Wales in the New England Tableland, a place called Armidale, and went to university in Sydney and over in the UK, and I was sadly a rugby player, so I sort of travelled the world playing rugby for a number of years and working as well, and studying and doing things like that, which is a lot of fun, except when you're age 40 and you're trying to pull yourself out of bed each morning. that was my background. But it's great that there are sports where the fat guy can still get a game. A little bit about ComplySpace. So what we are, in essence, is what I would describe as a professional services organisation that does things slightly differently, but We specialise in providing governance, risk, compliance services and solutions through to organisations throughout Australia. Not just schools. Where we actually started was, funnily enough, very much at the pointy end of the commercial sector in funds management. And our clients basically have two different characteristics. One, very heavily regulated. Two, a stable funding source. Okay, so think fund managers, boutique fund managers, very stable funding source from superannuation funds getting poured in, very heavily regulated. Medical, very heavily regulated. You know, those sorts of things. We just happened to start in the funds management industry because 10 years ago there was a major change in law in that space. We've now been the leading provider to boutique fund managers in Australia for government's risk compliance services. That's, funnily enough, not where our future is as an organisation. We've got about 40 staff offices in various capital cities around Australia and growing. Does anyone go for these guys? I always ask, because I don't meet that many.
No.
I can't stand them. Yeah, it was just terrible. It was tough going in there because I was managing the engagement process. It was really tough. It's as a Fairweather Swans fan especially. So, look, about 7 years ago, these guys, the New South Wales Federation of Community Housing Providers, came to us because they had a major change in law, and they knew that we basically go through, map changes in law, build policies, policy management system, deliver that, keep it up to date for them, do all of that sort of stuff. They'd heard about that. One of our former staff was then working there, and we went in there, and that introduced us to the not-for-profit sector. Which was a fantastic introduction at a range of levels, and I would say that the employment lawyer in me says that the most important of which was the people aspect, was actually understanding from a cultural compliance perspective the changing nature of the workplace bargain, the workplace relationship between employer and employee. You know, up here, you're working for the dollar. Bullying, central, it's... I'm not saying Sydney airports, but generally speaking, there's a reason why in the big employment cases, the defendant is Citigroup, is Goldman Sachs, is, you know, and the list goes on. It is a horrendous cultural environment, as wonderful as their websites are. The reality is you're measured on the number, right? How well you've gone against an index, that whatever that particular performance measure is. Here, fundamentally different. You know, our clients in here, if I take an example, Women's Housing Company in Sydney that look after essentially victims of domestic abuse, you know, that find them shelter. You know, it's a fundamentally different sleep at night factor. And as you would all well know in your respective roles and professions and involvement in schools. Cut a long story short, one of our charity clients had a director on, a director of Red Kite, sat on the board of Perth College, where we've got an office over there, and was at a council meeting and said, hey, we really should be using what we use at Red Kite. Talked to these guys at Comply Space, and I was over there at the time doing some seminars for Governance Institute, and met the bursar. And then I had three different bursars say, come and show us all, and it was Scotch College, Perth, Guildford. And next thing you know, they said, oh, we need what you do. And I was like, are you serious? My father was on the school council at, you know, Armidale for 12 years, and I was like, no, really? You don't really need this stuff. Now, we ended up bringing together sort of five schools, foundation group of schools, restructured our whole kind of corporate offering for schools and mapped out. And, you know, and I say that kind of respectfully because we're completely new in the school environment. We've been operating in this sector for 5 years. Okay, but about 85% of our resources are now allocated to schools. So we take it fairly seriously, as you can imagine. Look, here's some of our school clients. And what you can probably see there, I don't know, I mean, there's some similarities with some of them, but I think the most important thing here is the differences in the nature of the non-government school clients up here. You know, you've got your Shores and your Scots Colleges that you can, you know, in Queenwood and Guildford and even, say, Mentone Girls that you can probably compare at some level. But then you've got Tiwi College on Melville Island, even Lavalla College, which... You know, Joey's, another Mara school, is not actually on there, but it's another client of ours. And I sort of use Lavalla and Joey's as a good comparison because here's Lavalla, a regional Mara school in Geraldton, and here's Joey's, you know, top of the tree, Hunters Hill, like the sort of peak of the Mara schools in Australia, so they think. I can say that because they used to beat me in rugby all the time. I think that probably the one thing that binds all these schools is a commitment. What we find anyway is a commitment to trying to do things a little bit smarter, committing to better management systems to deal with the big issues like risk and compliance, And trying not to have to reinvent the wheel all the time, especially around policy management. And that's a huge challenge for schools, as you well know. There are obviously some others in here, like the Diocese of Sale, who I was meeting with this morning. So that's the whole system, and the Catholic Schools Office in Armidale is similar, and Sydney Anglican Schools Corporation. So there are some groups in there as well, which is a different model for us. And it's a really interesting one at a group level because of that whole issue of light touch governance versus centralised control. And that's the big challenge that groups always seem to have. And we're dealing with a lot of the Catholic Ed offices. So, and they're very different, all the Catholic Ed offices, is what we find. Let me now just go into the sort of presentation at large before I'll go and do a quick demo at the end. We'll start with just defining governance at a general level. Then I'm going to take you through some of these trends, some of the challenges that we see with schools generally. We'll touch on that kind of risk and compliance bit. Now, I almost apologise because there's slight amounts of educational references in here. There's reference points. It's not the full seminar I'd normally do for, say, the Governance Institute or something like that, but there's just some reference points to hang the hat on in there. I don't imagine that you'll see things here that you haven't necessarily seen before. It just might be a little bit of context and some different messaging. Then I'll do a demo at the end. But just before we do, I'll just get into a couple of myths that we find around this area. And it's a big one, because as a kind of a risk and compliance person across various sectors, you always walk in, and the employment lawyer, I walk into an employment law situation, I walk into a commercial organisation and we talk about the need to have policies and procedures, and they go, oh, well, who cares? You know, I haven't been hit by an unfair dismissal claim yet. We've been going for 10 years. You know, we're fine, we're family friendly around here, blah, 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 blah. Those sorts of comments that I've received over the years. And I sort of walk out and go, okay, well, here's my card. When you do get sued, give me a call. And sure enough, they get sued fairly quickly afterwards. It's a classic, because it's that whole thing around probability. And if you're not dealing with it and you think you're family friendly and you haven't got policies and procedures and you're not setting expectations, you're a disaster waiting to happen. That's on the corporate side. School side, it's slightly different. Let's touch on a couple of the things that we often hear and often see. Having a policy is compliance. Couldn't be further from the truth. Having a policy is one step toward compliance, but it's all about how will you implement your policies. Okay? In fact, in certain areas, having a policy but failing to implement is worse than not having a policy at all. Okay? And the classic area for that is safety. Okay? And if you think in terms of safety, think in terms of a building site. That's probably the easiest. If you have a great big sign up front saying we don't have any safety protocols in here, enter at your own risk, that tells people pretty clearly it's a dangerous area. If you don't have that sign up, but you say, we've got the best safety management system on that shelf over there, it's awesome, just come in. And then they walk outside the lines and they get crushed, you're going to be in a far worse situation than the first example. So implementation, that is always the big challenge in this area. And there's a plethora of case law that covers this particular issue. Basics around implementation is, got to have policies, got to communicate them, got to train and test your high-risk area, got to keep records of all of the above, and got to have continuous improvement loops and ways of getting feedback in to see whether or not they're working. You know, surveys, incident management systems, all this sort of stuff. I've got a little a diagram at the end that sort of covers those points. Myth number two, guidelines are policies. Don't know if any of you might have seen the document that was released when privacy changed back in 2014. And I think it was the AIS and perhaps one of the Catholic Ed offices put together a document that was a 138-page document on privacy. And I then saw schools adopt that document and put their logo on the front of it. What the document actually was a guide as to how to build your privacy manual, or your privacy program, I should say. It was a really good document. You know, someone had put a lot of work into it, engaged lawyers and done all sorts of things. Problem is, it wasn't a privacy program at all. And you see it a lot in the commercial space where lazy companies do this sort of stuff. They adopt Westpac's corporate governance statement, you know, and they're a small, whatever, diversified financial with five people in a room. And it's completely inappropriate. It's the same sort of thing with schools. We see this stuff going on from time to time.
where they just adopt a guideline and say, oh, the AIS in New South Wales, the AIS is obviously very big, and you know, oh, the AIS give us that. No, it's just not right. Okay, you can't put the logo on the pro forma. Treat them for what they are. They're guides. They're tools to assist. That's the sort of thing that we see. Number three, we only need to be compliant at re-registration. Okay, now look, re-registration is the time when we all focus on this, but every single board in Australia, educational regulator in Australia, is now focusing on this issue of continuous compliance. Okay, the CECVs, the other Catholic Ed Commissions, they're all looking at this particular issue at the moment. Because an example is in Victoria, where the CECV, which is obviously resourced through the Archdiocese, they have traditionally looked at re-registration on a 5-year basis, and then the consultants would ignore and leave the schools alone in relation to that aspect of compliance for those years in between. That's all changing right now, where they're now needing to get that assurance to see that the schools are doing it. So if the Catholics are doing it, which is a huge part, you know, that's 2/3 of the schools, of the non-government schools, then you're seeing that shift out. Of course, the rest of us have to do that anyway, but you're seeing now regulators shining the spotlight on it, especially in child protection issues. Okay. Myth number four, loss of registration is our greatest risk. Look, can anyone name a school that has recently lost its registration?
Yeah,
I can't either. I mean, I think about the amount of insolvencies in the corporate world in Australia, and you know, there's a huge number. So there's a huge number of companies that go bust. But it's rare for a school to lose registration. I mean, we know of the schools that have gone bust in recent years, but they normally get picked up by another church. That's the sort of thing that happens. So look,
they
challenged in court.
Yeah,
but
it was more due to the philosophy
of the actual school, was it? Right.
Yeah, and the curriculum.
Right.
So, it wasn't compliance that caused them to lose their position.
Yeah, right. So, the philosophical position. Mm. But look, this is, it's a really interesting one with schools. I nowhere in Australia, I would suggest that apart from government, the school sector is the most resilient sector that there is. I mean, where else do you find organisations that are 170 years old? You know, apart from government. I mean, the only other thing that I can think of that's about as close to being as resilient as schools is the National Rugby League. I mean, they just go from horror to horror and people love them more. It's outrageous. But look, in all seriousness, you know, the loss of registration is not your greatest risk. It's this stuff, isn't it? You know, in particular, the student duty of care and child protection issues are huge, clearly at the moment with the commission. But you know, I look at that one, WHS, or work depending where you are, offshore, OHS. It is a massive, massive issue. And that's an area where I've always found quite a weakness in schools compared to other sectors bear in mind, we've got clients of ours like what's now Pilbara Ports, used to be Port Hedland Port Authority and Esperance Ports and things like that. So, you know, they're very safety-focused organisations. But I compare them to, say, schools and the nature of the activity. Schools are at high risk for staff and for other volunteers and contractors and the like. Another one, ignore it and it will go away. Couldn't be a bigger myth, that one. Oh, we've got by for this long. Look, to be honest, the schools we talk to now, they're talking to us, which is a good indicator that they're not ignoring these sorts of things. Okay. Okay, governance. I apologise to the academics in the room for the APA referencing of Wikipedia. I just quite liked this definition, which is governance is the practices, policies, procedures, principles and values that guide a school and its business every day at all levels of the organisation. So what does that mean? Policies and procedures, that points to documentation. Now, fortunately, schools are policy-heavy zones. You're very comfortable with documents, not unlike lawyers, funnily enough. You know, we're comfortable with documentation. Lots of other sectors are far less comfortable with putting things in writing. Funnily enough, with schools, it's like, okay, well, oh, we've got to draft a policy. Let's get the English department to do it again. You know, you've got those resources. The difference in schools, given the age of many of them and the various issues, are that when we go into a school, we start with a gap analysis of existing materials. What we often find is multiple policies covering the same area, often which contradict each other. Okay, and that's one of the big challenges. So it's a siloed policy management approach and things like that. Practices, that points to the training, embedding and assurance systems in the school. Practices, what you do around here, your behaviours. So your key functional areas for that are training and embedding for those practices. Assurance is all about being able to prove that you've done it, okay? Gathering evidence to show. So if it's training, having evidence of training and all that sort of stuff. Principles, values, guiding a school, all about leadership and culture, okay? And look, another observation generally compared to other sectors is that schools are generally defined by the strength of the principal, okay? I have and yet to see a really good school with an average principal. But I've seen plenty of really good companies with average CEOs, okay, but strong management teams around them. So schools, if you've got an average principal, the school sort of suddenly comes down and enrolments are harder to come by and things like that. It's what we generally see. So that strength of leadership, and whether it's the principal or the principal and principal's team and it's more of a consultative approach and all that, it doesn't really matter, but that leadership is so crucial is what we see at that level. And the other issue is everyday all levels, so that's this continuous requirement. What does it mean at a sort of a general governance level? Look, this is the traditional view of governance. You know, what does the board do? It's an oversight role, set strategy, all of these sorts of issues. What does the sort of senior leadership team do? Well, they're implementing that strategy and developing the culture and setting the systems and things like that. And then you've got these regulatory compliance issues or regulatory governance issues over here of the big items around your educational requirements, your work health and safety, your duty of care, which is more common law, but now a lot of statutory drivers there. And of course, your fair work sort of IR type issues that come up. That's your sort of basic model for thinking about where the different responsibilities around governance and the different drivers come in. What I do find interesting is at the organisational governance level, compared to a commercial environment, what I often find is business managers and principals who, when it's coming to board paper time and setting strategy for board meetings, I'm going to say this, and it might be speaking out of school slightly, excuse the pun, but we'll often find that principals will manage the board a little bit more than, not so much the other way around in the commercial sector, but oftentimes in the commercial sector, the board might have a lot more influence over the management team, and we often find schools where the principals are really driving the board agenda a lot more from a really strong principal perspective. It can vary. I'm thinking of another school in Sydney, a very well-known one, where it's very corporate in their structure and with the delegations of authority and the like. Look, here's a bit of thought around a visual around the relationships between these different disciplines that I've just been talking about. Okay, because this is always a struggle when people often confuse risk with compliance, confuse governance with risk, all of that sort of stuff. This is a visual representation, not the only one, to think about. I can actually send this slideshow out to you. That's probably easier. I'll just make sure, I'll send it through CEN and make sure it gets to you. Okay. But if you think about compliance, a complaint handling program is a key part of a compliance program. Why is that? Because complaints are a key lead and lag indicator of compliance issues, aren't they? Someone makes a complaint, that's flagging a compliance breach, a potential breach, let's say, an issue that needs investigation. Compliance program is a key part of a risk management program. Why is that? Because risk as a concept is a future-looking concept. It's looking at future uncertainty. And when you think about your risks and think about the controls, you wind your controls back into your compliance program. They become compliance controls. Okay? Governance is overriding all of that, and that's your framework that puts all of those structures into place underneath, and none of it works without a strong ethical culture. And there's plenty of examples of where the cultures fail, and you can have the best systems in the world. Probably the biggest corporate one's HIH in Australian history. Terrible culture, wonderful systems. Doesn't work. Never works. It's all about the people, isn't it? It's all about the people. all of this stuff. So look, here are some of the bigger drivers that we see around the school sector, and I'm going to go into each one of these and make a few quick comments about each one. First one is this issue of the increasing complexity of modern day society. I say that like I'm a really old bloke and the world's changing and all this sort of stuff. Look, 10 years ago, well, when was Facebook? 2002, I think, 2003. So what's 13 years ago Facebook was started. Suddenly social media, okay? The world changed in the world of complaints and dissemination of information, immediacy of information, all of that sort of stuff. So what we see now is a fundamentally different society in terms of the expectations around communication, in terms of the immediacy of information going out, in terms of someone getting on and tweeting a complaint about something that's gone on at the school, and their 500 followers retweeting and this, that, and the other, in terms of someone taking a photo at a sports carnival of a student and then tweeting it, and suddenly you've got, you know, a bunch of students whose parents are complaining because personal information has suddenly gone out in the www, showing their children and things like that. In terms of cyberbullying, you know, it didn't even exist 10 years ago, this concept of cyberbullying, but now it's so incredibly insidious. And it's interesting because, I mean, in Victoria, there's new criminal provisions around sexting. Okay, there's changes in laws around that. These, as a concept, didn't even exist, you know, 12 or 13 years ago. So it really has shifted, and it really comes down to this one, the communication from one to a few to many, that kind of iceberg effect and that immediacy of information going out. The other comment that has been made to me by a number of our school clients over time is that a lot of the expression was this, and forgive me for using this expression, it was a lot of parents are now first-time users of non-government schools as well. So there's a lot of parents that went to government schools who for the first time are paying school fees for their kids to go to non-government schools, and they have expectations because they're paying a fee for service. Now, you know, as opposed to, I went to TAS because my dad went to TAS and my brothers went to TAS because, you know, and we'll probably send my kids to TAS, you know, all of that sort of traditional approach in that regard. And my son was very excited. My old school just went co-ed. My son's only 5, and he said, oh, that means I get to go to school with girls then, Daddy. That's right. That's right, son. That's right. And then one of my mates, who's 43, tried to re-enroll when he heard the girls were there. Anyway, that was just to wake you up, because it's a graveyard shift. Look, another key driver is a bit more spotlight on boards. In fact, in WA, that's actually been brought into their registration guidelines. There's a bit more spotlight now on board structure, having some proper, what I would describe as corporate governance type focus on boards. Look, it's a struggle. New South Wales just brought out a change in the requirements for responsible person training, which focuses the spotlight well and truly on boards. In fact, puts the Bunsen burner under the feet of boards, because now they have to do 4 hours of training around governance up there. Per year, and they have to do induction training, and I've got all my school clients yelling blue murder about this sort of stuff, because a lot of their board members sit on the board of various big commercial enterprises and things like that, so the Bosties might have created a bit of a rod for its back, but I personally think it's fantastic. I think it is fantastic. You know, schools are real big businesses, not big, large, medium-sized businesses, but that have such a huge responsibility to all of us. So it's not a bad thing that this is happening. Look, this is the big one. This is what I'm seeing is keeping business managers awake at night a lot more, which is the big one of compliance. It's an ever-changing environment out there. Here's just some of the areas that schools have to comply with. You know, talk about re-registration, and then suddenly you're focused on the Tassie registration standards. Talk about, you know, whether you've got early childhood international students for CRICOS, the changes in workplace safety. I mean, that's huge in itself, the recent reforms in recent years in this area, and obviously Victoria is still putting their feet digging their heels in on it, but the rest of us have sort of come to the party. So Victorians alike, that's it, isn't it? Student duty of care spotlight, well and truly, on this area. Absolutely well and truly. I was only joking about the Victorian comment there. Don't take offence. But then add to that privacy. Okay, last year, major shift. And what that was, this concept of privacy by design, really requires people to take a positive step around privacy compliance. It's not just, okay, we've got the policy in place, you beaut. No, you actually need to change behaviour and you actually need to put processes into place. That's what the law says. It's pretty clear. And there are real penalties this time around. And schools, and I just say this from having clients across a range of different commercial areas, schools are by far the most complex organisations that we deal with when it comes to the capture and storage and use of personal information. Because you just think of your average school. Your average school, say 650 students, right? You probably got, I don't know, what's the size of your prospective students and the personal information that you're capturing about them. You've got your alumni and the personal information that you're capturing about them. You've got the existing parents, their personal information, the prospective parents, the former parents. Then you've got your benefactors, your donors, your sponsors, your volunteers, your contractors, all of these, and it goes on. And then you've got the family of staff, just because staff are outside the Privacy Act. You've got family members. You suddenly get a school with 650 students, but you've probably got 12,000 records of information on others around that community. You're probably, without even knowing it, storing a lot of that in the cloud, and it may well be being stored offshore, and you're not disclosing that, which you have to by law. Yeah, it's all of these sorts of things, and the problem with that is that sometimes that can cause loss and put you in a situation where you cop a penalty from the Privacy Commissioner. Probably the biggest risk in most cases is more about reputational damage, okay? And that does have a real impact, that sort of reputational risk. Child protection, I'll go into that in a sec. Boarding, if you're running boarding facilities, food safety, classic, okay? Events management, another classic. Anyone that's serving alcohol on the school or running any events, anything like that. Excursions, the bane of existence, what it is a huge challenge for all schools around risk management processes for excursions. Yet to see a school that's doing it, I won't say really well, but that is not challenged by the management of excursions. Okay, so child protection, duty of care. Emphasise in this that, you know, original duty of care approach is sort of the common law approach to duty of care in schools. And I guess my position on this is a pretty simple one, traditionally, because it's what schools do. They're actually really good at it, is what I've seen. In general terms, because what do schools do? They provide, you know, I'm pretty simple guy, so I try to break it into the simple core competencies. And one, they provide an educational service, and two, they provide a pastoral care service. Okay, so what do? They teach and they care for students. And they're both often one in the same in many cases. So in teaching and caring for students, they're pretty good at their risk management and their duty of care obligations, at common law at least. What we're seeing now is a prescriptive approach to the statutory obligations around child protection. And one of the problems with that, if you cross states in Australia, is that because we're a wonderful federation of states, it's a state-based system, obviously, and we have quite different child protection laws in each state. If anyone reads the Queensland set of child protection laws, they're quite confusing, as to, in particular, your reporting obligations. You report according to your role, and that can be really confusing. I note in Victoria on this particular issue, on the 1st of July, the Victorian, under the Victorian Crimes Act, there's a new criminal offence in relation to child protection offences. In October last year, another criminal offence, that was the first of the criminal offences being introduced. So Victoria's probably leading the charge at the pointy end around criminal behaviour on this. And it's not surprising, really, because culturally, Victoria, if you look at bullying in the workplace, Victoria's led the charge on creating a crime out of bullying in the workplace and things like that. But I think that the message I'd put to you there is that's exactly where everyone else is going. Okay, that this is becoming more and more prescriptive and more high risk and really serious stuff. You just can't get past that. And so it should be, quite frankly. Workplace safety, I've kind of made my little, I've had my little rant on safety. Look, some schools are really strong at this, and some schools aren't. That's all. I mean, it's probably similar to other sectors. But I guess the point I would make, given that a number of you have or have held positions at that sort of board level, is that in particular the model laws in Australia make it very clear, and I mean the Victorian position has been clear for a while now, make it very clear what personal liability, how far it creeps. And it doesn't creep, it's just directly up to the board now. In fact, it goes broader than that to offices of schools. So it's a really important one. And, you know, no one sort of goes to work to do their job and do their best expecting to suddenly be personally liable for a breach of this legislation, but that's what the law says. So in one sense, when I'm talking to organisations, I'm going, protect your own staff who are at that senior level. Do this stuff properly, because they shouldn't be personally liable for it. They shouldn't stress about it. They're trying to do the best they can do. That's the basics of it. And let's face it, in schools, most of the time, the behaviour from staff members is they try to do the right thing. That's the culture of schools. So a lot of the stuff is actually understanding and knowing what you don't know and all of that sort of stuff. Don't want to start doing my Donald Rumsfeld impressions, so I'll do that. Workplace relations is another area that I, as an employment lawyer, often walk in and go, oh, okay, right, we could do a bit better here. I think culturally in schools it's always been a bit of a challenge, this particular area, the HR function. I see, and correct me if I'm wrong, but I often talk about performance review for teachers as an example. I see that compared to the commercial sector, it's often challenging for schools to run methodical performance review programs. And that might be sort of hark back to, say, more unionised environments. I don't know. Often there are strong enterprise agreements in place, things like that. But generally speaking, on the HR side of things, see that as quite a challenge. Most important thing about HR and safety, I would suggest to you, are that these are the two key functional areas that manage one of your biggest risks as a school, which is your staff base. Okay, and staff risk management is HR and Work Health and Safety, or OHS, whatever you want to call it. They're both sides of the same coin. Okay, they're the big functional control pieces. Complaint handling, another big one. Okay, complaint handling is actually built into your registration requirements in various states. Need to have a complaint handling system in place. Look, my business partner, we run this website, schoolgovernance.net.au, and it's really designed as an information site. We do a weekly newsletter. Jump on and have a look, and feel free to subscribe to the weekly newsletter. It's not all self-promoting at all, quite to the contrary. That's why we branded it differently. It was to get the dialogue going, to talk about these things. But we put a paper through that really walks through complaint handling in schools.
That's all right. Is that Siri?
Okay, so tell me about complaints, Siri. So look, that's one. And this is the next slide's the cliche slide around reputation management and complaints linking back to reputation. I guess this is important in the context of the Royal Commission in particular. It's this sort of the message of what you do today is going to affect people in the future, and it's often trying to tidy up what's happened in the past. And, you know, from a reputation perspective, that's huge, because if we look at the average length of time at the Royal Commission between an event taking place and an alleged incident taking place and the subsequent claim, it's, I think, 23 years. You would go, Master
Mayor. Sorry, first time travelling, wanted to leave before.
No dramas. I'll make sure that this,
that'd be great.
This gets around.
That's great,
David. No problems. And when you think of that 23-year time lag, if I look at, let's take a recent example, Knox Grammar in Sydney. Okay, now that was a school that I nearly went to. And Knox Grammar has, 2,600 kids, I think, now. It just owns that corridor in that northern part of Sydney almost. It's now, when I was a young bloke, it was probably at 800 kids, so it's just gone bananas. But they've got 750 staff. And I think that there are only three staff that were there when the various incidents took place. Okay, so when you look at a 750 staff member base, only three were there 23 years ago. So it's a significantly different management team. It's a very different culture. It's a very different school in terms of size. It's huge now. It's a massive school. I've got a mate who actually teaches there, and he can't speak highly enough of the place. And my godson goes there. I know the school pretty well. But, you know, this issue, they're having to deal with that now, and so reputation management is absolutely crucial around that, and that's something to think about. And that's where complaints handling is really strong. And, you know, the word of the culture of the place back then was, if a complaint came in, it was under the carpet, reputation first, let's not deal with it. And that's sort of come out in the Royal Commission, hasn't it, that particular school. Incident management, huge driver. Okay, this is leading into the final big driver, but you know, it's that standard one of schools having to think about not just having incident forms that someone fills out and then they go somewhere and maybe something happens with them, actually systemising incident management. Okay, and whether the incident is a complaint, is it a near miss or an injury, okay, is a privacy inquiry, is someone identifying a hazard, whatever the incident. It's a function of systemising the process so that we can the traditional way of thinking about it, we can identify systemic issues, we can improve all of those sorts of things. The final one's policy management. And I almost ask for forgiveness for this slide because it's pretty ugly, but it does have a lot of the key issues that come up in policy management. I've already said my piece about policies in schools, but the challenge that we have here when it comes to policy management, maintenance, integration, and incident management is really all the moving parts, okay? You've got to have your policies. They've got to be kept up to date. That in itself is a huge challenge, okay? We have lots of changes in laws. Like in Victoria in recent years, a lot of the focus has been around bushfire management, as an example, for obvious reasons, anaphylactic shock management. Tassie just had a change of registration standards, and off the top of my head, I can't remember what. They ripped out a couple of things which were quite strange. Couldn't quite get why, but anyway, I think we've gone back to the board to ask them about it. But look, you're constantly getting these changes, and it requires an understanding of how these policies interact with each other in these different areas. Okay, let's just quickly on risk management. Let's not get too carried away with risk management. It's really just management with a four-letter word in front of it. Equally, that four-letter word could be good. Okay, but it's a big but. When we talk about risk management now, we're actually talking about a structured methodology. Believe it or not, your schools and many others have always followed this structured methodology in many different areas. You just haven't had to build it and show that you're following the structured methodology. Now, this is the international standard on risk management. And it's got 11 principles, it's got a framework for managing risk, and then it's got this process. And the process is the thing that most of us are most familiar with. Has anyone ever come across it? ISO 31000. Right. So look, I imagine that you would have in the medical space quite a bit. Look, when you read this stuff, it makes absolute sense. It's common sense. It's a standard. Of course, it's going to be common sense. Smart people have come together to write a roadmap for how you should do this. And it's very effective. The risk management process is this, okay? And it's a continuous process. It looks a bit like a sewage treatment plant, but it is a very effective process around having communication and consultation, establishing the context, going through identifying risks, analysing, evaluating, building out your treatments, and having a monitor and review loop built in there. Okay, all makes sense. And what we find when we're implementing these sorts of systems with schools is we actually go, okay, show us how you do this, what do you do there, where's the risk register, blah, blah, blah. What we find in most cases is that the school is already doing this really well, and we retrofit it into the process, and suddenly staff at school go, oh, we actually did that really well. It's already in there. And they go, oh, fantastic, and we can all immediately get reports out and they can start to set, and then we start to go to the gaps at that point. So it's just a good way of getting engagement. At a reporting level, these are the sorts of things we normally see that work very well. You're going to have your sort of 7 to 15 risks that you report at the board level, and you might have a protocol around that, you know, your catastrophic risks, anything that's changed dramatically, trended up dramatically, anything that's got a serious reputational risk associated with it, child protection at a high level, things like that. Then you're going to have your executive team type risks, and that might be another 30. So at this point, you've probably got 45 key risks. And in a mature state, you then filter down to your operational risks as well that filter out. But it takes time. Risk management at a structural level is very much a journey. It's not a destination. Okay? It's going to be a maturity issue for the organisation. Compliance, really quickly, just conceptually, if you think about compliance, if you see this black line here, that treat that as the present, the here and now. Risk is a future-looking concept, looking out into the future. Compliance is about here and now and the past. And when we talk about compliance, in general terms, we'll talk about legal and regulatory compliance, organisational compliance, and contractual compliance. There are other compliance areas like risk treatments and incident treatments and things like that. But basically, the way it works is that your risks looking out into the future, you feed your controls back into your compliance program, and if there are breaches and things like that, they'll feed back in and change your risk profile and might identify other risks. Okay, so that's that kind of relationship between the two. Complaints sitting over the top are good lead and lag indicators for both. Complaint comes in, oh, that's flagging a risk. Complaint comes in, oh, that's flagging a compliance breach. That sort of or something, a compliance issue, let's just say. Compliance also has a standard, and the older standard is the Australian standard. That's now been upgraded to the new international standard, ISO 19600. I think the really important thing about the new standard in this particular area is it takes into account the need to integrate risk and other things, whereas the old one was very much standalone. This is how compliance works in the standalone context. That's why we often say governance, risk, compliance, and we throw them all together, because there needs to be a level of integration to make this stuff work. So here's your broad brush governance framework. Policy management. Okay, remember I said with implementation of policies, you've got to have the policies, keep them up to date, communicate them to your staff, train and test the higher risk areas. Okay, got to keep records of all of the above and have feedback loops, whether it's surveys, whether it's an incident management system that tells you that this stuff's not working. Basically have an improvement loop coming back through. The assurance piece is about your task risk incident management and needs some way of capturing your key compliance tasks, of assigning them to individuals, monitoring the performance of those, controlling, reporting and improving on them. Bear in mind, your policy management side of things tells you what your staff are meant to do, and assurance tells us whether or not they're doing it. That's the best way to think about it. So the question of whether or not they're doing it is always a much higher level one, because you're not going to go down like Big Brother and push that out everywhere. You just, you know, when it comes to re-registration, you want to capture the key evidence of tasks and task completion or compliance, so that when it comes to re-registration, you go, bang, there it is, we've done. Got the policies, and here's evidence that we're doing what we're meant to do. That really, pretty simple stuff, hard to do in practice. I'll give you a quick demo now, and I'll just come back at the very end. Okay, so what I'm going to show you here, it actually flows straight from this slide. We've developed two different software applications that deal with, one, policy management, and two, assurance management. I'm going to show you the policy management in a little more detail, because the assurance management can be a bit overwhelming unless you've got your head right into the space. Here's a demonstration site for our policy management tool. It's called Fundamentals. This is just a web-based demo site, so it's just for any school. First key message of this, what we've developed with Fundamentals is a policy management tool through which we can mass distribute customised policy content for each school. So a school will have its own site, but it will pick and choose the modules of policy content that it wants to have in place. And what we are, for want of a better description, content specialists. So we've got editorial teams and content experts and all of that who spend their time, sounds like a really exciting job, trawling through changes in law, drafting policies, getting requests from clients to draft policies and things like that.
I'm just glad someone does it.
So I pull my grey hair out. We've modularised that content in using technology to try and build little tools around it and deliver it in a more sensible way. And the reason why, 10 years ago, we were drawing lots of pictures on whiteboards saying traditional lawyers would draft this up in paper, give it to you, and you've got your precedent documents, and then come back and pay us to update it later. And we said, no, we've got to do it electronically. We've got to be able to update it as and when it changes. But most importantly, it needs to be customised for each client, where you can add your own content into the same environment, so it becomes the school's management tool. And over time, it's less about legal and regulatory compliance, which is our big driver. We've modularised the content, so we've got a little school board portal that we've built for boards, and we built that through the Governance Institute years ago. Originally, that was focused for ASX companies, and now it's nearly all not-for-profits grabbing it. Human resources, OH&S, WHS, student duty of care, and in the governance space, risk and compliance and registration. So if I'll jump in there and just show you. So what we've done around this, so you can see risk management, and that's built to the standard. These are all modules, so you pick and choose. But something like registration, just because everyone's familiar with that, sadly, we have to be across the laws in every state and territory. So did I already make my Bob Hawke statement? I must be losing it. That must have been yesterday I said that, and I thought I'd made it. Well, this is where I sort of confess to being a fan of Bob Hawke in one particular regard, where he said that if we started Australia all over again today, there'd only be different state and territories for Sheffield Shield. That's look, this is a classic. You know, it's just out of control in various areas. But if you pick up, I mean, just because we're talking about Tassie, but look, here's an example. So we map the different requirements, and then we build out the policy against those, and those policies are then customised as you go through. Okay, so that each school can then go in and customise those policies further. In fact, when I say each school can do that, we actually do that with the school as part of the the implementation. So if I pick on VRQA, which is a much more prescriptive requirement in Victoria than it is in Tassie. And in Victoria, it requires you to have a lot more in terms of the safety issues. So you can pick up things like there's a bullying prevention and intervention policy, and you start to see the way these things are mapped out. And there's variable fields and merge fields and all of that sort of jazz. So some of the other big sort of more policy heavy areas are things like work health and safety. And the way in which most staff actually interact with this the most is by going to the WorkSafe policies, and there you've got all your policies. So important message is that schools will put other policies that they already have into the same environment. We'll, of course, start with doing a gap analysis of existing policies with the school, which is really important, because that tells you whether that enables you to make the decision of let's not throw our valuable policies out, but if they're not of value, let's throw them out and start again. And we sort of go through and sort of chop them all up and then integrate them and put them together in here. From everything from sun protection, I know that in Tassie we just recently rolled out a new sun smart policy down there. Mm-hmm. And then the big one, student duty of care, where there's a lot of overlap between safety and student duty of care. And you can see there your statutory obligations around child protection, all the way into things like excursion management and critical incident management, stuff like that. If I pick on that one, that's a very long policy. I don't like long policies, but this one's sort of necessarily long. And most of the time when we review these as a critical incident policy as a standalone, it's normally about 40 to 50 pages long. But you can see straight away the beauty of it being web-based with hyperlinks across. And down here you can see the hyperlinking across to the different types of incidents and things like that. So look, that's quite strong in terms of the use of that, and schools can switch policies off if they're inappropriate. They take complete control. We don't sort of force anything down anyone's throat, but we keep it up to date as the law changes. The other part of that, the training and testing part, where there is a legal driver around particular policies, we also structure in their various training modules around that. So this is just an example in induction training, okay, and that's designed so that staff can do that at their desk, or you might run through one at a PD day, and then you'll set them a test afterwards. So we've got corresponding tests for all the training. Here's some of the tests. Here's an example. First question is always the same: have you completed the training? Last question is always the same: acknowledgement, and that creates that accountability loop, closes it off, makes the individual accountable and showing that. It's simple stuff. It's not kind of taking people to accredited level of knowledge. And in fact, every school that we provide our services to, they already use external trainers as well for different things and external services. But at the end of all of that, we've got now a record to show that we have done our training. And if I pick on myself in the spirit of making a fool out of myself and no one else, there's my bullying prevention and management training, 27%. So I'm either a bully or a victim, just yet to work it out. But look, that's the level of detail. It's not going too far. Lots of schools put their own quizzes in as well. It's pretty easy with the content management system. So that sort of gives you a flavour on the policy management side of it. The other side's the assurance piece. And most staff will only ever interact with assurance via logging of incidents. And a typical one is what this enables you to do from an incident management perspective is have a web-based incident management tool that you can take your phone, you can click on the link and it takes you to this, and there's a really nice web-based form that you can drop the stuff in, right? And that then sends the incident up the chain into the assurance system to whoever's the incident manager, who can then go in and actually see that particular incident and can see just what's happened in relation to that incident. And here's an example of one. In this case was a staff member named Heather Hudson broke a leg skiing in Thredbo, and the Victorians always laugh and scoff and go, well, that was her first error skiing in New South Wales. And you can see different fields of information. The really important thing about this is you can create your own fields. We kind of have a starting point. We work with schools to get that going. But the great thing about this tool is you can link your incidents to different risks in your risk register, and you can create workflow on the back of it, i.e. in this particular case would be lodge a workers' comp claim. The assurance tool is incredibly powerful. It can become the back end of your claims file, all of that sort of stuff. But it's a really important tool in terms of managing your risks, managing your tasks, having your board reports, all of that. But it's all about implementing it properly, understanding what the drivers are. So we do a lot of work with schools to work out how to make that come to life, okay? That's the front end, which you can see lots of different information from. Let me just finish off now. There are three essential kind of system-based requirements. If you're going from a manual policy management approach, an assurance management approach, and you say, right, we want to systemize and get to an automated way of doing things, more efficient, you know, doing more with less, all of that. Here are your three key ingredients at a system level. You've got to have your policies, I've gone on about that. You've got to have a way of communicating and publishing and authoring new materials, integrated, all of that sort of stuff. And you've got to have a way of gaining assurance, so what we call GRC software. Truth is, none of that works unless you're dealing with this stuff properly, and that's the people aspects, okay? And from our perspective, that's our biggest challenge with every school, which is understanding the culture of the place, understanding what you're trying to do in what time frame, how we can come in, who the key driver is internally. You know, everything requires a change management plan, because at the end of the day, this stuff's all about supporting the school and doing what it does, which is teaching and caring for students. And if you sort of come over the top of that, it can create a lot of pushback. And we've just learned through a bit of experience some good ways to do it and some not so good ways to do it. And we're constantly learning on that. At the end of the day, when it comes to governance, risk and compliance, it's about acknowledging that in every organisation there's a bit of this. Okay, but my organisation, there's a bit of this. Look, there's a bit of this in every school. There's certain times in a school's life where you shine the spotlight on one particular piece and you really shore it up, but then the gap becomes bigger here and, you know, there's more wasted information and stuff like that. The stronger we can systemise this at a kind of a holistic level, around governance, risk and compliance, the closer we are in moving from this sort of state to that sort of state. And that, I guess, is always our kind of aspirational target around this stuff. I'm going to wrap up now. I've gone over by 3 minutes. There's just some reference points for you. I'd suggest, you know, if you want to have a look about us, the comply space, but the school governance website is a very strong one for information. I mean, we've now got an editorial team of three that just pumps content down that. And I often go to it to prepare and find out stuff and things like that, and use it for education for myself. Because there's just so much information these days. You just can't be across everything. So, look, I'd urge you to jump on and have a look at that. And my details, if anyone wants to get in contact. There's my details. So as I said, I'll get the make the slides available for you. So thank you very much for your time. I hope that was worthwhile.
Welcome to an iTech 15 speaker presentation. This file has been brought to you by Christian Education National. Enjoy and connect to www.cen.edu.au for more information.